The Supreme Court has given judgment in one of, if not the, biggest property cases of the year, S. Francis v. Cavendish Hotel London Limited. Back in October, ahead of the hearing, we invited Joanne Wicks QC and Ben Faulkner of Wilberforce Chambers, who act for the appellant tenant under instruction by David Cooper, to discuss the case and the arguments involved. Now, they have been successful at the Supreme Court. We've asked them back to analyse the court's ruling. Welcome back, Joanne and Ben.
Thanks, great to be here.
Thanks for having us back.
So first, just in case there is anyone listening that is unfamiliar with the case, can you quickly summarise the background and what the dispute involved?
So, very briefly, this case concerns Ground F, the redevelopment ground in the 1954 Act. And it's a very special and quite extreme case because the landlord put together a scheme of works that was completely destructive and made no real-world commercial sense, all with the sole purpose of getting the tenant out. There were two quite important factors to the landlord's thinking. The first was that the only purpose in doing these works was to get the tenant out. And secondly, and as will become important, there was a condition to the landlord's intention, which was that if the tenant had vacated voluntarily, the landlord wouldn't have wanted to carry out the works. So the landlord was only doing the works because they were necessary to get the tenant out. And those were the two key parts of the landlord's intention that formed the subject matter of the argument before the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. And so what happened at the court below?
So in the court below, we had lost completely at county court level. We'd had an appeal to the High Court on a number of different issues, of which the part that went to the Supreme Court was only one. We'd had a mixed experience in the High Court. We'd won some points and we'd lost some points. But critically, obtained a leapfrog appeal certificate to take this particular issue to the Supreme Court to have a look at.
It's a case that Lord Sumption, in his judgment last week, described as a remarkable case. I already mentioned that you'd been successful on appeal. So can you outline for us what exactly the Supreme Court decided last week?
Yeah, so actually it's quite simple, really. There was this key piece of evidence that Ben's already talked about, that the landlord said, if the tenant goes voluntarily, I won't do these works. But in order to get the tenant out, I will do these works. And the question that arose for the Supreme Court was, is that kind of intention, an intention to do the works in some circumstances but not in others, a sufficient intention for the purposes of Ground F? And the Supreme Court said that when you look at Ground F purposively, that is to say you understand what Parliament was intending to achieve by Ground F, you can see that intention, which is conditional upon the works being necessary to satisfy Ground F, isn't sufficient. And that's because Ground F is given to landlords in order to enable them to carry out redevelopment. They get possession under Ground F because they want to carry out works. And it sort of turns it on its head completely if you say, well, you can use Ground F to get possession by doing the works. Lord Sumption said the interest, which is the legitimate interest of the landlord, which is protected by Ground F, is the interest in redevelopment. It's not the interest in having possession. That's the very thing which Ground F, and indeed the Act as a whole, is intended to limit. So it was ultimately purposive, a policy-driven interpretation of the phrase the landlord intends. What kind of intention is sufficient for that purpose?
So can you sort of set out in straightforward terms what you think this will mean for how Ground F operates in future cases?
Well, the old test, the existing test, remains the same, but there's a bolt-on to it as well. So we're still having to ask, when it comes to the landlord's intention, is there a genuine intention to carry out these works? Is it sufficiently firm and settled? We're still having to ask whether the landlord has a reasonable prospect of being able to carry out the works. Is there planning permission in place, funding, etc.? But now there's a bolt-on question, and that question is, would the landlord still want to carry out the works if the tenant voluntarily vacated or the works weren't otherwise necessary to get the tenant out? And that question is sometimes going to be quite a hypothetical question. It might not even have occurred to the landlord to ask itself that question because the tenant showed absolutely no sign whatsoever of wanting to vacate voluntarily. It might have been absolutely determined to fight on, but the question still needs to be posed hypothetically because it tells us what the nature and quality of the landlord's intention is and whether it is conditional in this particular impermissible way. And the other important part of this bolt-on test is that it doesn't just apply to schemes as a whole, but it also applies to each element of the works. Mm. So if the landlord would have carried out a scheme of works in any event, even if the tenant voluntarily vacated, but has devised extra beefing up works in order to meet the substantiality requirement in Ground F, for example, then those extra beefing up works, putting in a new lift, a new staircase, lowering the basement, whatever they may be, will be subject to this same test, and it may be that the landlord would fail in respect of those elements, and then looking at the remainder of the scheme might not be substantial enough.
If I could just chip in there, something that the Supreme Court has said is useful in order to provide evidence of what the landlord's intention is, because obviously when you talk about somebody's intention, you're talking about something that's not actually visible. Mm. They say two things. One is that the landlord's motive is relevant evidence. So if there's evidence indicating that the landlord is doing the works only to get the tenant out, and that's going to be an indicator, evidence that the landlord's intention is qualified in this impermissible way. And also, if, as in the Francis case, you have works which are completely useless, then that's also going to be evidence that the landlord only intends to do these works in order to get the tenant out, and its intention is qualified.
Yeah, so as you said, with this bolt on this idea of looking at that motive, it's going to be something that is very fact sensitive, and as you've said, it sort of depend on evidence in each particular case. And
yeah,
I'm sure you've seen and heard that there have been some commentators who have expressed surprise and even a little bit of concern about the ruling and how it will create or could create difficulties for landlords going forward. Obviously, I assume you must believe that the court has reached the correct decision. but what have you made of that reaction, and what would you say in response?
I think the reaction's been really, really interesting. And for me, it's revealed a bit of a split in the legal profession, actually. I've had lots of people coming up to me and saying, you know, this is obviously the right result. It's wrong for the landlords to be able to put together essentially fictional works to get their tenants out. That's clearly not what Parliament intended. And they've said to me, look, I would never advise a landlord to have done what the Cavendish Hotel did in this case. But other people have said to me, oh my goodness, we've been advising landlords for years to put together artificial and fictional works, not perhaps on quite as stark a way as in the S. Francis case, but it's completely normal, they say, for landlords to add in some works that they wouldn't do if the tenant was going to give up possession voluntarily. So I think that's been a really interesting reaction, because it has been no reported case before this one in which that question has been explored. And yet there it has certainly been a part of the legal profession that thinks that that's standard practice, as it were. What I would say in response is, really, imagine what would be the case if the Supreme Court had decided the decision in the other way. Imagine it had said to the Cavendish Hotel, it's absolutely okay to put together a completely artificial package of works that is of no use to you and of no use to anybody, solely designed for the purpose of getting this tenant out. And in effect, as Lord Sumption says, in effect allowing you to just throw money in order to buy out your tenant's statutory rights. And if the Supreme Court had come down on that side, then effectively the 54 Act is dead. The 54 Act is supposed to give tenants real and substantial security of tenure. And if landlords can effectively get around the security given to tenants by putting together an artificial scheme of works, then we might as well not have the Act at all. So yes, there have been expressions of concern. There were expressions of concern on the part of the landlord's team to the Supreme Court about the potential complexities that might arise, mm. additional layers of evidence, the risk that landlords might simply not tell the truth. And the Supreme Court grappled with those. The Supreme Court recognised that cases may perhaps become longer and more complicated. There may be different evidence put forward than would have been the case in the past. But that was a necessary consequence of giving effect to what Parliament wanted when it enacted the 54 Act.
I might just add as well that these sorts of questions, looking into the landlord's motive, have always been relevant when assessing the landlord's, whether the landlord has a genuine intention mm-hmm. or not. Now, there is a new battleground which has been opened up by this case, but it's more on a continuum, evidentially, with what we already have.
Do you think some of the sort of divide in opinion depends on whether lawyers tend to act more for landlords or more for tenants? Do you think that influences their reaction to the case?
I'm sure it does, up to a point. I mean, of course, we always try and be objective, don't we? But people can't help reflecting the particular balances in their own practice. And if you practice in an area where you have considered it completely normal for years and years and years to encourage or advise your landlord clients to add in works that aren't really necessary or that they wouldn't really want otherwise just in order to get the tenant out, it probably does come as a bit of a surprise. But it is interesting that has sort of become an orthodoxy without any case law, mm-hmm. in fact, validating that particular approach.
And in the light of that, you mentioned this is the first reported case sort of raising exactly this point, but that there is that sort of established way of dealing, it seems. Do you foresee that there'll be more of these types of cases coming to court now?
Well, there's certainly going to be quite a bit to work out now about the implications of this judgment. We have to start looking to see how far-reaching it is. For example, though it's a decision on ground F, there's a large degree of commonality with ground G, mm-hmm. And it may be that this decision will affect the intention requirement in ground G. There are going to be all sorts of questions when it comes to building lease cases, for example. I mean, there is a lot more to be worked out, and we're looking forward to getting stuck in.
What do you think lawyers will be advising landlords now in future cases in which they're seeking to rely on or considering relying on ground F?
Well, landlords who have genuine plans for redevelopment have absolutely nothing to fear. And there are lots and lots of those landlords out there, and they can use ground F and they don't have to worry about it. Clearly, what solicitors are going to have to advise their landlord clients is that they're going to have to be cautious about not only doing things which are in fact designed to get the tenant out, but also things that might look like they're designed to get the tenant out. So one of the features of ground F cases, which is particularly difficult for tenants, is that because the landlord's intention is judged at the date of the trial, it's very open to landlords to change their schemes of work and to adapt them over the course of the proceedings, which might take a year or more to come to court. That's hard for tenants because they can take advice at the outset of litigation about the prospects of success and find that, 6 months down the line or a year down the line, when they've invested quite a lot of money in the litigation, they're faced with a completely different scheme of works or something which looks much stronger from the landlord's perspective. Now, that's going to be quite difficult for landlords to do in the same way, because if we have that same kind of cat and mouse position, the tenant's rightly going to say, well, hold on a second, you produced Scheme A and I responded to it and said Scheme A is problematic for you because it's not sufficiently substantial or because it requires you to do something that you're going to find difficult to do. And here you've produced Scheme B. Well, Scheme B must surely be a scheme that you've put together only for the purpose of getting me out. So I think landlords are probably going to be advised to wait until they're absolutely sure about the scheme that they want to put forward to the court before pressing the button on it. And it'll be interesting to see what the litigation processes require of them by way of disclosure, for example, and provision of evidence and expert evidence as to at what point they will actually have to come forward with the formulated scheme that they want to take to trial.
What advice are tenants in a similar position to S. Francis likely to receive going forward?
Well, obviously tenants are going to feel fortified by this decision. It is a tenant-friendly decision. It significantly rebalances the approach to Ground F in favour of tenants. But I think the advice to tenants is still going to be realistic. As I said, there are going to be lots of landlords who've got totally genuine redevelopment schemes, and they will still be able to use Ground F. And the Supreme Court has reminded everybody of what's already established, namely that it's not for the tenant to say, look, you, the landlord, should be doing something completely different, or it would be reasonable for you to put together a different kind of building redevelopment. But clearly, tenants are going to be looking much more closely at how schemes of works put forward under Ground F have evolved, because that's likely to give clues about whether or not they really are schemes that the landlord would put in place if the tenant gave up possession voluntarily.
Well, many thanks, Joanne and Ben, for coming in and analysing the decision for us. I'm Jess Harold, and you have been listening to On the Case from EG.